Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So I'm listening to your episode about the intriguing evolution of espionage over the years and the development of what we now know as professional intelligence services, and how it used to be kind of intriguing characters by the sound of it who would travel the world through their legitimate business. And then kind of report back as a sideline to the king. And it makes me think about kind of the things that in the calculus of international affairs countries have tolerated or turned a blind eye to, because I think that's something that's very intriguing and maybe we'll talk about in future episodes, is the distinction between diplomatic cover and non-diplomatic cover for how intelligence agencies might choose to operate in a certain country. And the first sometimes is almost a semi-consensual arrangement, which is really, really intriguing, I think. Another type of consensual arrangement that on the surface seems a bit perplexing, at least to me, is the concept of foreign or overseas military bases. And in line with the recent episodes where we're talking about military and intelligence and the Iran-Israel stuff especially, it brings to mind for me the U.S. overseas military bases, including one facility that has been in the press a lot lately, and that's the U.S. CENTCOM's attempt to create a kind of information center to oversee President Trump's so-called Board of Peace and the implementation of the second phase of the ceasefire reached in Gaza, where Hamas is supposed to be demilitarized. And there's been some very colorful reporting in the Israeli media, certainly in the English-speaking Israeli media, describing this facility where you have kind of the U.S. Army stationed on one floor, Israel on another floor, and people kind of sitting around in almost like a startup-like environment. Problem solving. The characterizations have been tinged with a lot of skepticism about it, but it's on the more open end, I guess, of, you could say, a base that the US has in Israel, in the sense that they're inviting media to tour it. But there's other ones that are far more off limits, or, you know, even to journalists. And those are, for example, we talked about how things like ballistic missiles are detected when they're launched. I was going to say when they're launched as hostile projectiles, and then I realized probably that's every ballistic missile ever. I can't think of a friendly reason to send a ballistic missile over to another country. But you have these incredible long-range sensors that are operated by the US, I believe, in some really distant part of the Negev Desert in Israel, which to me is a totally fascinating concept, because I've spent a little bit of time in the Negev Desert, driving the border with Egypt. Totally fascinating thing to do when it's open, Road 10. And it's like the most sparsely populated place I think they've ever been. My late grandfather used to say he used to spend years as a commercial traveler in rural Ireland, and he would always tell me that when you're going in a real, you know, remote stretch of land, that you can kind of know how remote you are by the electricity poles, I guess, back in the day. Or maybe they're still there, those little over the road things that bring power and telecoms. And when you don't see those, you know, you're really out in the sticks. And I remember driving down towards Road 10 in Israel, and I think it's the first time that I've ever driven here somewhere, which is a really perplexing experience. It's such a densely populated country. And there were nothing except a firing range for the IDF on one side. Anyway, I'm going way off topic here. So when we talk about foreign military bases, it seems like a strange concept, right? That a country which is sovereign, even if it's an ally, would agree to let another country have a military base. And I've read that in some cases, they're even like off limits to the host country. Another example is the RAF bases in Cyprus. And I believe I watched, there was some YouTube video once about the US military's overseas bases. It's a gigantic global system that they operate. So Herman and Corinne, I'd love to chat about the practicalities of overseas military bases. It's obviously done, you know, consensually with the host country, but how does that arrangement work in practice? It seems even if those two countries are allies, there must be some mutual benefit that a country agrees to have a foreign power have a military position within its own territory. Herman and Corinne, let's talk about the strange concept of overseas military bases. How does it work? Over to you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem, watching the rain hit the window. It is a bit of a gray day outside, but we have a really fascinating topic to dive into.
And I am Herman Poppleberry. It is good to be here, Corn. I have been looking forward to this one since breakfast. Our housemate Daniel sent us a voice memo earlier today that really got me thinking. He was listening to our recent episode about the history of espionage, and it sparked a whole new set of questions for him about how countries interact when they are supposed to be on the same team.
Right. Daniel was specifically curious about the practicalities of overseas military bases, not just the big famous ones like Ramstein in Germany, but the more nuanced consensual arrangements between allies. He mentioned the recent developments we have seen with the Iran-Israel situation and the United States' involvement in Gaza and the Negev Desert. It is a timely question, because there has been a lot of talk lately about these new coordination centers and how they actually function on a day-to-day basis.
It is such a great angle because most people think of a military base as a fortress with a big wall and a foreign flag flying over it. But in 2026, the reality is often much more like what Daniel described as a startup environment. We are seeing these facilities where you have soldiers and analysts from different countries literally sitting on different floors of the same building, sharing coffee and data.
Exactly. So today we are going to explore the mechanics of these arrangements. Why would a sovereign country allow a foreign power to set up shop on its soil? What are the actual benefits for the host, and how do they balance that with their own national pride and sovereignty? We will look at the legal frameworks, the economic impact, and some of the second-order effects that people rarely talk about.
And we should probably start with some of the recent diplomatic developments. There have been ongoing discussions about coordination frameworks and international stabilization efforts in the Middle East. These represent attempts to create new models for multinational cooperation in conflict zones.
That is the perfect place to start. Daniel mentioned this idea of a coordination center where the United States military and the Israeli military are working hand in glove. We have seen reports about the Civil Military Coordination Center in Kiryat Gat. It is not exactly a base in the traditional sense, but it is a hub for managing everything from aid delivery to the planning for international cooperation efforts.
That facility in Kiryat Gat is a fascinating example of modern military cooperation. It is reported to house about 200 United States troops along with various international delegations. Like Daniel said, the descriptions coming out of the media make it sound less like a barracks and more like a high-tech office space. You have logistics experts who are used to navigating natural disasters working alongside military planners.
It is an integration, right? One official described it as a hand-in-glove situation, where the host country remains the hand and the coordination center becomes the glove. But that raises a big question about sovereignty. If you are the host country, at what point does the glove start telling the hand what to do?
That is the central tension of every overseas base agreement. In the case of the Kiryat Gat Center, it was set up specifically to monitor the ceasefire and coordinate the flow of essential supplies into Gaza. For Israel, the benefit is clear. They get the technical expertise and the international legitimacy that comes with United States involvement. It helps manage a situation that is incredibly complex and politically sensitive.
But there is also a trade-off. By allowing this center to take over a lot of the day-to-day oversight, the host country is essentially ceding a degree of operational control. We have seen reports that some United States logistics experts were frustrated by the level of control the local authorities still maintained over the perimeter. It is a constant negotiation.
It really is. And when we look at the broader picture of international stabilization efforts, it gets even more complicated. The goal is to have a multinational team that can handle demilitarization and law enforcement in Gaza. But as of right now, even though the command structure is being developed, the actual troop commitments are still being negotiated. Countries like Turkey and Qatar are part of discussions, but getting boots on the ground is a different story.
It is interesting that Daniel brought up the Negev Desert too. There has been a lot of speculation about high-tech surveillance and radar sites in the south. While there is often talk about secret bases, the reality is usually focused on specialized technology, like the AN-TPY-2 radar systems. These are incredibly powerful X-band radars that can see for thousands of miles.
Right, and those are often the most sensitive sites. If you have a radar system that can detect a ballistic missile launch from over 1,000 miles away, that data is gold. But who owns the data? Usually, if it is a United States-operated system, Washington controls the flow of information. They share it with the host country, but that gives the foreign power a certain amount of leverage. It is a technological security umbrella, but the person holding the umbrella gets to decide when to tilt it.
That brings us to the why. Why do countries agree to this? If you were a country like Japan or South Korea or Germany, you were hosting tens of thousands of foreign troops. On the surface, it seems like a massive imposition on your sovereignty. But when you look at the mutual benefit, the math starts to make sense for both sides.
Absolutely. For the host country, the biggest benefit is often the security guarantee. It is the ultimate deterrent. If you have a few thousand United States troops stationed near your border, any adversary has to think twice before attacking, because an attack on those troops is an attack on the United States. It is called the tripwire effect. You are essentially buying a piece of the world's most powerful military to act as a shield.
And it is not just about the fighting force. It is about the infrastructure. When a foreign power builds a base, they are bringing in billions of dollars of investment. They build roads, they upgrade telecommunications, and they create thousands of jobs for local civilians. In many cases, the host country's economy becomes deeply intertwined with the base.
That is a huge point. We have seen this historically in places like Okinawa. The local economy there is heavily dependent on the presence of United States bases, but that is also where the friction comes in. You have the economic benefit on one side, and then you have the social and environmental costs on the other. Noise pollution, land use issues, and the occasional criminal incident involving foreign personnel can lead to massive protests.
I remember we touched on this a bit back in one of our earlier episodes when we were talking about complex networks and infrastructure, but it applies to physical space too. The host country has to manage the domestic political fallout of having a foreign military presence. It can be a very delicate balancing act for any government.
It really can. And then there is the cost-sharing aspect. This is something that has been a major talking point in recent years. Many people do not realize that host countries often pay a significant portion of the cost for these bases. Countries like Japan and South Korea contribute hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars a year to support the foreign troops on their soil. It is called burden sharing.
So the host pays to have the troops there, but they also get the protection and the economic boost. It is a very complex transaction. But what about the foreign power? What does the United States, for example, get out of having 700-plus sites around the world?
It is all about power projection and response time. If a crisis breaks out in the Middle East or the South China Sea, you do not want to be starting your response from Virginia or California. You want to have your equipment and your people already in the region. It is the difference between responding in hours versus responding in weeks.
It also gives you a front row seat for intelligence gathering. If you have a base in a strategic location, you can monitor communications, track regional movements, and maintain a constant diplomatic and military presence. It is about exerting influence without necessarily having to go to war.
Exactly. And the strategy has evolved. We used to see these massive, permanent fortresses. Now, the trend is moving toward what they call the lily pad strategy. These are smaller, more flexible sites with a minimal permanent footprint. They can be scaled up quickly if needed, but they are less of a target and less of a political burden for the host country.
That sounds a lot like what Daniel was describing with the Kiryat Gat Center. It is not a city-sized base. It is a specialized hub designed for a specific mission. It is more agile.
Right. And that brings us to the legal side of things, which is where my inner nerd really gets excited. Every one of these arrangements is governed by something called a Status of Forces Agreement, or a SOFA. This is a bilateral treaty that spells out exactly what the foreign troops can and cannot do. It covers everything from who has jurisdiction if a soldier commits a crime to whether the base can import its own food without paying local taxes.
I imagine those negotiations are incredibly intense. You are essentially writing a mini-constitution for a specific piece of land.
They are, and they can take years to finalize. The SOFA is what protects the sovereignty of the host country while ensuring the foreign military can actually function. For example, in many agreements, the host country retains the right to inspect the base, but the foreign power might have exclusive control over certain high-security areas. It is a constant push and pull.
We saw a high-profile example of this recently with the withdrawal from Niger. The United States had built this massive drone base, Airbase 201 in Agadez. It cost over $100 million and was a key hub for counterterrorism in West Africa. But when the political situation in Niger changed after the coup, the new government revoked the agreement.
That is a perfect example of the fragility of these consensual arrangements. Even with all that investment, the host country still holds the ultimate trump card. If they tell you to leave, you have to leave. The withdrawal from the bases in Niger was a long and complicated process that wrapped up in 2025. It shows that these bases are only as stable as the diplomatic relationship between the two countries.
It is a huge risk for the foreign power. You spend hundreds of millions on infrastructure, and it can all be gone if a new government takes over. But on the flip side, the host country loses the security umbrella and the economic benefits. In Niger, the departure of United States and French forces has left a huge vacuum that other regional and global players are trying to fill.
It is a domino effect, and that brings us back to the situation here in Israel and the ongoing discussions about international cooperation. Various proposals are being discussed for how to create new models where the responsibility is shared among different stakeholders. It is not just one foreign power, it is a collaborative effort.
That seems like it would make the legal and practical side even more of a headache. If you have troops from 5 or 6 different countries, do you need 5 or 6 different SOFAs?
Potentially, yes. Or you create a unified framework that provides an umbrella for all the participating nations. That is what various proposals are attempting to do. They are trying to move away from the old institutional approaches that people feel have failed in the past.
It is a bold experiment. They are essentially trying to outsource the security and reconstruction of a conflict zone to a multinational collaborative effort. There have been various proposals for how post-war recovery could look, with visions of economic development and stabilization by the mid-2030s. It is a complete reimagining of what post-war recovery looks like.
It is. But the skepticism is real. Many observers are pointing out that while these proposals look impressive on paper, they still lack clear commitments for standing forces. They have proposed command structures, but they do not have the boots on the ground yet. And some of the countries that were expected to contribute have been hesitant to commit.
This is where the practicalities that Daniel asked about really come to the forefront. You can have the best plan in the world, but if you do not have the logistical and military capacity to implement it, it is just a document. The Civil Military Coordination Center in Kiryat Gat is the testing ground for this. If they can make it work there, it might serve as a blueprint for the future.
And it is worth noting the role of technology here. We are seeing a shift where the physical presence of troops is being supplemented, or even replaced, by advanced surveillance and coordination tools. If you can monitor a border with drones and AI-driven sensors from a center 20 miles away, you do not need as many people in the danger zone.
That is a huge shift. It reduces the risk of casualties and lessens the political footprint. But it also changes the nature of the partnership. It becomes more about data sharing and less about shared sacrifice on the battlefield.
Which brings us back to the mutual benefits. If the host country gets access to that high-level tech and intelligence, it is a massive force multiplier for their own military. They can do more with less. But again, they become dependent on the foreign power for that technology. It is a different kind of tripwire.
So, looking at the big picture, overseas bases are transitioning from being simple military outposts to becoming complex nodes in a global network of security, technology, and economic influence. Whether it is a coordination center in Kiryat Gat or a drone base in the Sahel, these sites are where the abstract concepts of international relations become very real.
Exactly. It is where the rubber meets the road, or where the analysts meet the soldiers. I think the takeaway for Daniel, and for all of us, is that these arrangements are far more dynamic and fragile than they appear. They require constant maintenance, not just of the equipment, but of the political trust between the nations involved.
That is a great point, Herman. It is not just about building a runway, it is about building a relationship. And as we see with various international coordination efforts, we are entering a new era where those relationships might be managed by boards and committees, rather than just traditional embassies and generals.
It is going to be a wild ride to see how this plays out over the next few years. The reconstruction of Gaza and the stabilization of the region are the biggest challenges on the global stage right now. The success or failure of these new types of coordination centers will tell us a lot about the future of global security.
Well, I think we have covered a lot of ground today. From the legal intricacies of SOFAs to the high-tech reality of modern coordination centers. It is a deep rabbit hole, and I am glad Daniel pushed us into it.
Me too. It is these kinds of questions that make this show what it is. We love digging into the nuances that the headlines often miss.
Absolutely. And hey, if you're listening and you have a weird prompt of your own, or a question about something we discussed today, we would love to hear from you. You can get in touch through the contact form on our website at myweirdprompts.com.
And if you are enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app or on Spotify. It really does help other curious people find us. We have been doing this for 325 episodes now, and the community we have built is just incredible.
Yeah, it really is. It is amazing to see how many people out there share our fascination with the obscure and the complex.
All right, I think that is a wrap for today. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We will be back next week with another deep dive. Until then, stay curious.
See you next time.
I was just thinking about that startup analogy Daniel used. Imagine a world where all international diplomacy is just one giant co-working space.
Honestly, with the way things are going in international relations, we might not be that far off. Can you imagine the fight over who gets the good desk near the window?
I think the United States usually just brings its own desk. And its own chair. And a very large security detail.
And a very fast internet connection.
Exactly. Anyway, let's go see what Daniel is up to. I think it is his turn to cook dinner.
I hope it is not that experimental soup again.
No promises. Thanks again for listening, everyone. You can find all our past episodes and more information at myweirdprompts.com.
Take care, everyone. Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.